Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. I'm your host, James Renford Powell, author of the Renford Books, and host of not only this show, but we have 11 total shows with the Radio by Renford Network. We have hosts in New York, Boston, Denver, Seattle, Little Rock, and a number here in the Memphis area. This is a wide number of types of shows. They're all talk shows, but different genres. And we'd welcome you to come to Blog Talk Radio. That's B-L-O-G-T-A-L-K. blogtalkradio.com/Renford. And check out the different shows that we have on the network. And then give us an email at iamrenford, I-A-M-R-E-N-F-O-R-D, at gmail.com and tell us what you think of the shows, what you like and what you don't like. We welcome it. We will also invite you to go to youtube.com, type in Renford Broadcast Network, and there you will find the Core Concepts lecture and interview series, The Bookman Show, my television show on Saturday nights at 9:30 on Comcast Cable Network, Channel 17, and five other sections on that YouTube site. That's a big one. Tonight, if you have somebody that would like to listen to the show, and maybe they're out of pocket or not online, they don't have to listen to it on blogtalkradio.com/Renford. They can call 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. And if you would like to ask a question, whether you're on the internet listening or whether you're on the phone listening, you can press the one button on your touchtone dial on the 347-838-9142. Press the one button and that will flag me to bring you in to question me or my guest. And my guest tonight is Sharon Page. And Sharon Page, I'll give you more information on her after the, she's the founder of Damascus Road Residential Center, and we'll be talking to her about her goals, missions, and what she's doing in the Memphis area. And we'll get to Sharon as soon as I complete the Renford Revelation. This is my blog. You can go up to IAM or IAM-COR.org/blog. That's IAM-COR.org/blog. And you can see the Renford Revelations going back many weeks. Also, those shows on blogtalkradio.com/Renford go back 5 years or better. So there's a lot of shows in the archive there, and you're welcome to peruse them till your heart's content. Tonight's blog is called The Bible and Metaphysics. The dictionary says that metaphysics is, quote, the branch of philosophy concerned with the study of the nature of being and beings, existence, time and space, and causality. This is an incomplete definition. It would be more to the point to say that metaphysics is the study of what comes before a physical manifestation. Meta, mind, physics, physical. What creates? Thought creates form. Without thought, there can be no form. This is the subject of other articles and essays I publish, so I'll restrict my comments here tonight to the Bible and metaphysics. There are certain passages in the Bible that are clearly metaphysical in nature. In other words, these passages have more depth to them than the traditional interpretation. The fundamentalist will argue simply that it means what it says and that's that. Others will argue that every chapter of every book in the Bible has metaphysical or deeper meaning. In both cases, this is dogma talking and not reason. The fact is, there are portions of the Bible that are little more than Hebrew tradition, and still others are instructions on how to build the organization that we see manifested in many denominations in one form or another. In order to be very clear as to what I mean by metaphysical, I'm adding the definition from Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary, of or relating to the transcendent or to a reality beyond what is perceptible to the senses. The word comes from the title of a treatise by Aristotle, Metaphysica, a division of philosophy that is concerned with the fundamental nature of reality and being that includes ontology, cosmology, and often epistemology, a study of what is outside objective experience. My specific definition is that metaphysics is what comes before a physical manifestation. As a man thinketh, so is he. In other words, thought creates form, and without thought there can be no form. The term metaphysica was given to a work Aristotle called The First Philosophy, which was cataloged after his works on physics and thus labeled after physics. This has been taken to mean beyond physics, but before physics would be accurate. It's funny how the truth will come out. The universal laws as taught by all the great masters is integral to any proper study of metaphysics. It begins and ends within the study of self. It is not a study of comparative religions, doctrines, or rituals. It's not a matter of choosing one belief system over another. It is really not about religion. Neither I nor any graduate of the Institute of Applied Metaphysics is holding forth on which religious system is better. This study could make you a better Christian, Jew, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, because you will have a clearer understanding of the primary principles about which the master spoke. On the other hand, you may come to recognize the ultimate master. It is worth considering quotes from theologians of some world religions. Fritz Schuon, in his book Islam, states, "To say God is also to say being, creating, revealing. In other words, it is to say reality, manifestation, reintegration." He follows this up with, "Islam then is in essence a truth and a law, or the truth and a law, the former answering to the intelligence and the latter to the will." Swami Bhaskananda, who was one of the first to make Hinduism known to North America, refers in his book, The Essentials of Hinduism, to what he calls supersensuous or metaphysical truths. He says they are the foundation of Hinduism. It is true that the laws are the foundation of Hinduism, and I suggest that they are the foundation of every religion. However, man and illusion are never far apart. Relative mechanical minds work that way. The important truths from which we seek understanding are those invariant principles that are literally aspects of God. They are, as the Swami said, not man-made. Buddha's wisdom clears one from the illusion of life and reveals to us both the significance and insignificance of this world. It brings to life cause and effect. One seeks his Buddha nature in the Dharma, the path, and its principles are the universal laws, which they refer to as the middle way. In the Hebrew text, the universal laws, which were poured out before there could be so much as a clod of earth. It's a very beautiful passage. You can read Proverbs 8:22 through 31, which is saying it had to be in place, these principles had to be in place before there could be life on this vibratory level. Therefore, any higher manifestation of God in man would express these laws. In Christian texts, we are told, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came to be through him, and without him nothing came to be. What came to be through him was life, and this life was the light of the human race. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness is not overcome it." John 1:1-5. To Christians, this passage can mean only that the Word was Jesus. What does it mean that Christ was the Word? It means the Word was made manifest, or the laws explained by example, on our level of understanding. And if you remember, in Matthew 13:35, Jesus said, "I came to reveal the secrets that have lain hidden from the foundations of the earth And in the same verse it says, and he spake to them in parables, and without parables spake he not. So this is his process of revealing the mysteries. It means that being a manifestation of the Word, Christ would express aspects of God personified. This being the case, what else would he teach but the divine self-expression, which we can understand as the universal laws? Every time Jesus opened his mouth, he expressed, illustrated, or explained one of the universal laws or some aspect of a law. Jesus' parables were taught so that even the illiterate could gain from them. If they were prepared to see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, when it comes to the universal laws, there's virtually no end to the benefits and levels of understanding possible. When doctrines and dogmas are removed, these pristine principles can be seen to be the only real guide. And that is my Renford Revelation for this evening, October the 7th. Now to my guest Sharon Page is the founder of Damascus Road Residential Center. She is also the founder of Tennessee Learning Academy Incorporated, and she has created a center for young people who need it. And we want to talk about what she's doing with that and what her obstacles have been and where she's going from here. Welcome to the show, Sharon.
Thanks, Jim. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to present our program this evening with you.
Well, I think people ought to know about what you're doing. Can you give us a little idea of the mission of Damascus Road?
Absolutely. Damascus Road is a nonprofit Memphis-based intervention program. Our program is designed to prevent nonviolent youthful offenders from becoming involved with the criminal justice system. Secondarily, our program is aimed at providing support services to families, which will keep children out of state custody and at home with their families. So, again, we're trying to keep the children out of the criminal justice system and trying to get them out of state custody.
You have been able to garner some support from major organizations in Memphis, haven't you?
Well, we have received support from various foundations, primarily one of the largest, Walmart. However, our support hasn't been exactly what we needed to be from the Memphis community. That's because our concept is relatively new. Memphis has never had a program where we would provide a one-stop shop for serving children, not in a medical sense at all, but children who need services immediately, whether they're homeless or, you know, families aren't easily found or located. But basically, we have been attempting to provide our services in the Memphis community for children who are at risk of being homeless or becoming incarcerated.
Well, you have a substantial facility, and there's been quite a bit of donation in terms of furnishings and things, so you could house children there immediately, right?
Absolutely, and yes, we have received lots of furniture, lots of gifts. In fact, our facility itself was donated to our nonprofit. We've received so many things that would be required to care for the children. In fact, we have 100 beds available for children who may be homeless or displaced. We do have federal agencies who have donated furniture and computers and what have you to our agency. However, after being fully set up and prepared to operate, naturally it takes a lot of funding. So right now what we have are a lot of community-based volunteers and leaders who offer their in-kind services to support the program. I'm sorry?
I was going to ask, are there grants now that are supporting funding-wise, or are you kind of treading the water on your own?
Well, we're pretty much treading the waters on our own. However, we have sought out support from local governments, and we're hopeful that we will be eventually funded by our local government. But right now, It's a kind of a one-man show. We kind of provide all of the financial support that is needed personally, and we depend on our volunteers who come in to maintain the property and to offer their other professional services to the organization.
Are you running into any obstacles politics-wise?
Oh, we have plenty of those. Well, we do have some agencies and individuals. As you know, this is a political year. As a matter of fact, you know, we have a lot of that going on tomorrow in our city.
That's what made me think about it.
I'm sorry?
I said that's what made me think about it, is that our election is tomorrow.
It is, in fact. We will be electing our mayor, and we will be electing city council members as well. We have had some issues in our attempt to receive funding from one of our local governing agencies, and which would be a tremendous deal for a nonprofit like Damascus Road. However, there were well, there's competition, then there's, you know, envy, then there are political agendas. There are a lot of reasons that people would seek to prevent us from operating, because if you've never seen a program like this, it becomes a threat to those who serve the children after they've been incarcerated, or agencies who benefit from having the children detained. Our program is an intervention program, a program that prevents children from entering the system. Naturally, if they cannot enter the system, the person waiting on the back end doesn't get a child into his program. So we are seeking to remove the opportunity for these children who really have committed status offenses, just minor offenses, and they should not be detained. They should not be incarcerated, and if they are incarcerated and they have nowhere to place these children staying longer than they should, they learn new skills, and that's what we're trying to prevent. We would like, in fact, for children, when they have committed a minor offense, have the opportunity to come to our community-based facility, receive social services, receive clinical services, or whatever the support is that may be needed for them. We would provide an assessment to make that determination. So if, in fact, we receive a child, they get the counseling, and the child can go back home to his family. If we are not available or open to receive the child, then the child is either left to wander the street or eventually becomes detained in a juvenile justice system.
Are there any other organizations in Memphis that provide the same service?
Absolutely not. We do have other organizations. They work with felons, however. These are children after the fact. We're trying to prevent the children before they touch the system. So we're not interested in, you know, seeing a child, you know, through the pipeline, so to speak. We really want to stop it and prevent it before it happens, provide a service, because once the children are detained, then naturally they're fingerprinted. That's a whole new ball game there, because now getting, you know, a record expunged or getting things changed, or the stigma of detention, the problems for the family as a result of having a child who is not at home to help support the family, it becomes a little bit difficult. It gets worse. I like to think of it as quicksand. Because once they hit the system, it becomes all too difficult to get them out and to really kind of make them whole again.
Yeah, they kind of have to reach a point where they go into the military or go someplace else to get away from it, isn't it?
Absolutely. One of the things that we're hoping to do with our program is to provide a 24-hour community-based site, so that we can take the children in and provide the services that are needed and eliminate completely the need for children who've committed minor offenses, shoplifting, trespassing, things like that, to just keep those children out of the system, provide the counseling, and help stabilize the family, get to the bottom of the problem, the why the child has encountered law enforcement or what have you, so that we can help via social services to get the family back on track, leaving the courts out of it, leaving the state out of it, and just doing the neighborhood, the village thing, the family thing to support and make whole the child and his family.
Sharon, I want to take just a minute and remind listeners, if you would like to ask a question of Sharon Page and what is going on with Damascus Road, you may have a more insightful question than I do. Please dial 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142. And press the 1 button on your touchtone dial. If you're online now and you would like to ask a question, all you have to do is just press that 1 button, and that'll flag us to bring you in for your question. Sharon, how in the world did you get involved in this? I mean, where did the idea come from? I mean, what's your background?
Well, actually, I worked as a foster parent for nearly 20 years, so I got an opportunity to see the children who were at risk, and I got to see that there were no services available for these children, and naturally, I had to do something about it. The big part of this is that it was such a burden on my heart until through a vision, I just continued to be hounded about doing something, and I did. So I sought to set the program up, to begin to write the various components of the program, and I've just continued to work regardless of the day, the time, the hour, and what have you. I know that the service is needed, and certainly not just in the city of Memphis, but a program that offers 24-hour support for children is needed across the country. This is not just a Memphis or a Shelby County issue. We need programs like this everywhere to support children, to keep them out of the system. Now, our program intends to start with our day service, which would be a service that would allow children, if they are truant, to be brought to our facility to remain until the parent is able to pick them up. The goal here is to keep children with an active school status. We want them in school. They need to be in school. So being at our facility during the day, in the event they're truant, we would put them back into an academic program. And secondarily, you know, domestic violence is such an issue, even with the children. What we offer is a cooling off site. That simply means whether that's a victim or a perpetrator, or you got siblings that you need to separate, one of those children may be able to remain at home. The other one needs a bed, a place to go, or support services, counseling, or rehabilitative services.
Basically, you identified the need. Where did you go to find answers to how to fill that need?
Well, that's the easy part, because actually I have people who are constantly contacting me or bombarding me with the needs of their children. And because there are so many needs out there for the children and so few services, it just unfolds. It's very easy to see the need and to respond to just what the family is needing at that particular time. So they actually come to me. It's not a very difficult thing. One of the other services that we're hoping to offer during our day treatment program is to have a temporary holding site. And that is if our children's services needs a drop-off place for a child temporarily until they can locate the family or the next of kin, there is a place where children can be safely delivered to. Now, when I say safely delivered to, that means that individuals serving the children will have the appropriate background checks. There's a structured environment. We have nutritious food services, academic services, and clinical support as well. So it would be a very easy thing to do to support children if they are needing a temporary holding site.
So you're really talking about other cities across the country that need this sort of thing. You're really kind of developing a prototype that could be, once operational, could be viewed by people in, all over the country.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and I've actually gotten those questions and inquiries from across the country and certainly from nearby surrounding counties, because the need is just tremendous, because we're all dealing with the same juvenile crime. We're dealing with, you know, families who need support. So certainly it could be a model for major cities. It would help kind of ease the fears and reduce social intolerance for the children and provide some structure for the child who may be displaced or who's just going through particular, you know, adolescent needs or whatever the needs may be in the child's life. Again, we do have 100 beds at our facility. We have a three-story facility here in Memphis, and we have 100 beds whereby we would be able to take children in on a temporary or rotating basis or as needed. We simply do not have that service available right now. The other thing that we offer is a parent education service whereby we parents would be allowed to come in, participate in parenting classes so that children can be reunited with the family and they can remove themselves from the, I guess, the court-involved sort of issues. Then again, we offer year-round support for children and families during non-school days. Of course, you know, children get out for fall break, Christmas break, spring break, what have you. They need to be engaged. And, of course, you know, our academic program supports the after-school children, preventing latchkey children and supporting the working parent, because after school, children need somewhere to go and some productive, positive activity to participate in. So
does that include maybe a parent who's got problems there that might come with the child?
Are you referring to the academic program?
I was referring to the facility, to be able to come with the child to the facility and then maybe do the classes and so forth that you mentioned.
Okay. Now, our residential services are for children only. As a matter of fact, serve the children 0 to 17. However, families can come for the counseling. And the good news about our program is that if a child is involved in our program, the family of that child is also welcome to participate in our activities as well, which means the child may be in our after-school program. The parent can participate in our GED classes or our recreational activities or receive some of our social service support,
but not be staying overnight, for instance.
No, our residential program someday will include the opportunity to support families who need residential support, but right now these would be unaccompanied children. They might be runaways, they might be truant, they may be abandoned, they may not be able to locate a foster home for the child, because all children do not fit foster homes. We know that. However, we would be a stabilizing point until such appropriate placement is found for the child. One of the other things that our program does, we support three major agencies. One would be the school system, which means we would provide the opportunity for a truant child to come to our facility and the academic support with after school and what have you in those areas. And, of course, we support the state placement agency by serving as a temporary holding site pending the location of family or placement in the foster care. And lastly, we support law enforcement because we would provide a secure drop-off location with social workers on duties and other professionals who, again, have been appropriately background checked. And it would be an opportunity for law enforcement to bring a child and leave a child at an appropriate location so that they can put that police car back in the service, back on the road, because we recognize they're not babysitters or social service agents. So we'd like for them to do their job and leave the social work up to us.
Do you conduct tours that if anyone listening to the show tonight that wanted to see firsthand what Damascus Road is all about, do you conduct tours for them, or how do you let them see what's going on?
Well, at this point, we're not conducting tours. We are more or less preparing to open our facility. And the reason we're not conducting tours is because we've done a whole lot of that for a long, long time. But if there was an investor or donor who wanted to tour the facility, I'd be more than happy to offer them a personal tour of the facility. But as a public opening, that is not something that we are at this time able to do.
Now, I know you've had a lot of contributions in terms of the material, the furniture, and so forth. But if somebody wants to contribute material, time, or money, is that still welcome? And how would they go about doing it?
Well, certainly they can always send a check to us. Our address is P.O. Box 753553. Memphis, Tennessee, 38175 is our zip code. They can also visit our website, which is www.damascusrd.com, to learn more about our program.
Do you have pictures and things up there on the website?
Yes, they have the opportunity to look that up, and we even have a video, a YouTube video. So if you go to YouTube and look up Damascus Road Residential, you will see that's a wonderful way to get a very colorful tour of our facility and our program components.
And so to get more information, the best thing, they can call you, but they and talk if they want to immediately get involved, or they can go to www.damascusrd.com. Is there a phone number they can call?
Certainly. They can reach me at area code 901-273-4336.
Okay, and then basically you're the one who fills the questions. Whatever questions they have, you take care of it.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
And when do you think what do you see as being your date for really commencing operations, let's say?
Well, we're really hoping to open up and push out probably around the middle of November, where we would begin offering services. Academic services is where we will start. So we're hoping that we can start doing that by the middle of next month, if not sooner than that. So we are very busy gathering all of our information so that we can present our program to the community. And let me just say that one of the things that we're very big on is presenting our program and curriculum as an evidence-based program. We like to work with programs that have been proven in our work with at-risk children or families and what have you. Our family nurturing program is as well an evidence-based program. So all of the programs that we use are, in fact, evidence-based.
Can you explain evidence a little bit more? I guess that's proven, is what you're saying?
Yes, an evidence-based program would be a program. For instance, with our program, we use the program provided by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, or OJJDP. So we use those types of program. One is called Models for Change, and Too Good for Drugs and Violence. Those are the types of programs that have proven statistically to really help children who are at risk. sometimes because children have been so traumatized and they have so many events going on in their life, they're not able to just sit there and work with a regular standard curriculum. So there's a method and manner and information that must be presented to the children that really has proven its weight. So we'd like to go with programs that, you know, have already positioned itself as successful.
You mentioned three major agencies or parts of our society that you're cooperating with: schools, state placement agency, and law enforcement. What's been the reaction from them? I mean, do you go and speak to schools? Do you get a good reaction from them, or state agencies, or the police?
Well, actually, we do not go to the schools and speak to them. We just recognize that there is that need in the community, and we work with the heads of these agencies to offer our program for implementation. And now I've talked with the various agencies, and quite frankly, they're on board with our program because they know there's a need. They know that our program would relieve law enforcement by having a place to deliver the children to. Children's services would have a place to deliver the children to or pick the children up from. And certainly, you know, it would be easier for a parent to pick a child up at our site and know that the child during their stay at our facility is receiving academics, nutrition, counseling, and all the other things that they need. Our program is more or less a seamless operation. Children brought to our site, say a truant child brought to our site, we have so many hours before we must contact the state agency to report a child not being picked up. Once we do that, should the agency choose to have the child remain at our facility, then we're able to assign the child a uniform, get them a curriculum, put them on a nutrition schedule, and do all of the things. Now, the reason I say that it is seamless because the child doesn't realize that they were not picked up by a particular time, and we're able to just go on to our system and switch them over to residential, although they may have come into our facility as a truant child. So, again, we are a one-stop shop facility, which means we can take them in regardless to what the situation is. And, again, we only deal with nonviolent youth offenders. We do not take in violent offenders. That would be handled by the other agencies. So we're a community-based facility seeking to keep the children out of the system. And one of the other components to our program is the fact that we are trying to keep the children inside the county line. We do not want the children removed from our county to be delivered to another county to a bed somewhere far away from their family. Research has shown that that is not a very successful operation, that doesn't work very well. So children do better even though they're not at home. They know they're not that far from their family. So we like to keep the biological family together.
Now, you mentioned schools, state placement agencies, and law enforcement. What role are churches playing in this? Now, I know I asked that question because I know that the program was introduced to me from Reverend Eric Donaldson, the senior pastor at Unity Christian Church. And I know that some of the donations in terms of furnishings and things have, I think, come from Bellevue and other churches. What other role are they playing?
Well, the faith-based community is on board. A lot of the things that we would need from the faith-based community, they have, in fact, already donated. In fact, we were able to receive musical instruments from the Promised Land Church of God in Christ. We have been able to receive in-kind services, not only from Bellevue, but, you know, the different churches. And there's also been the Get Well Road United Methodist Church here who have helped us tremendously. So there have been a whole lot of churches who come in to help, to paint, to clean, to scrub, and do yard work. They've done so much work. The only thing we're really waiting for right now is an opportunity to serve the children, and we can't do that without funding. The building is ready. The beds are ready. We have everything that we need to just roll out and make a difference here in Memphis, but we can't do it without funding. So we are in
What's the funding requirement? I mean, what do you see as being the likely budget per year?
Well, to operate a facility like ours, and let me explain, that is a 35,000 square foot facility with 100 beds, which would require approximately 300 employees, and we're talking 24 hours a day operation. So the bottom line is something like 2.5. So if that's what it would take to really go, you know, full blown with the project. Now, we're not trying to do all of this in one swallow. So we have phased out the various services that we would start with. I mentioned earlier that we would start with academic services, which would be, you know, our after-school program and a lot of the other grassroots programs, the parenting and the different things that we could do. Initially, something like $100,000 would help us get the kite in the air, if you will. But since we're not planning on doing all of it at one time, and meanwhile, you know, we are in pursuit of grant funds, or we're looking for donors, we're looking, you know, for grantors, people who would understand that our city is in dire need of funds so that we can support our children. Now, without hesitation, it is crystal clear that the children are angry, they're frustrated, they're in trouble. These children need help. They need somebody to talk to them, to mentor them, to listen to them, to care about them. So our program seeks to, you know, provide that service through our program, which is multifaceted. I mean, we have a lot of different angles, but we are simply pushing out very gently, very easily. It's a slow walk in the park, as I like to say. So, again, we would be working with tutors and teachers and mentors initially, and then just graduate and introduce our services in other areas to the community.
Well, to do what you are planning to do, though, you it's like a business almost startup. You think you would require about $2.5 million full blown to do everything?
Absolutely. We've
and
crunched the numbers.
What would the budget be like annually? Any figures on that yet?
Well, not at this point, but we do know on average that it would take $2.5 million annually to operate it because, you know, we would have the salary of 300 employees, you know, the feeding the children, the uniforms, you know, there's just so many systems that we'd have to have in place and to maintain, you know, the state-of-the-art services. We have to have that. And naturally, as I see it, of course, the children are well worth it because if we do not reach out to our children, we're going to have a problem tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. You know, we can help them today and redirect them and offer them support or hope, or they will choose their own avenues. And a lot of times that's not exactly what we want to do.
When a child comes in like that, when you're fully operational, you're starting off with the after school portion,
mm-hmm.
there, so you could operate with a whole lot less than 2.5, but you're starting out with that phase. How long does a student stay with you?
Are you talking about academics or residential?
A residential.
Residential. Well, a child who would come to us into our residential program, that time is determined by the agency that may have referred the child to us. They would make that determination. We just ensure that the child receives the appropriate services while they are in our care. So the child may be with us 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months. We don't know. But we would be there to serve the needs of that child and as per the agency instruction.
So the you've already got a team of teachers who have created a curriculum for them, right?
Well, we do have the curriculum. However, it teachers, it comes from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention.
Mm. So
we do
have social workers
who are ready to work within the community. We have trained social workers who could work with the families or work with the child and, you know, coordinate the partnerships between the agency and the school.
Hmm. Now, you also have, and I assume that the Tennessee Learning Academy was something you developed before Damascus Road. Can you tell us anything about it?
Sure. Tennessee Learning Academy is our legal name. Damascus Road happens to be a project under Tennessee Learning Academy. Damascus Road is our residential service. But Tennessee Learning Academy is education for the entire family, for the adults and for the children. Anything that a person from 0 to 99 would need to learn, they are welcome to learn it at Tennessee Learning Academy. It's not just for the children, so we stretch out far and wide because we realize that education is so key to so many of the things that happen in the life of a child, a person, and because, you know, we believe in continuing education, they would be able to be supported there through vocational or GED or whatever the services they may need, including parenting. So it's not just for the child, it's for the entire family.
Now, you mentioned grants. Do you have a number of grant writers? What all are you actually, besides the funding, what else are you asking the general public for?
Well, at this point, because we already have our facility and we're fully furnished, the only thing that we do need right now is funding. So, you know, naturally I have to be able to pay the employees or support the volunteer efforts and do a tremendous amount of things, you know, everything from the utility bill to insurance coverage to the purchase of books and software. There's so much that needs to happen at this stage.
Now, the facility, you say, is about 35,000 square feet. This originally, what was this facility originally?
It was originally a nursing home.
And that was built by whom?
I'm sorry, you said that was,
Who built that? Who had that facility before
you? Kim and Wilson. It was built by Kim and Wilson. And it's a wonderful facility. We've had it checked with a structural engineer. The facility is standing strong and looking very well. So we are just on a fast track to utilizing this facility so that we can, in turn, take care of our children.
What do you see is there anything that you would like to talk about tonight in explanation of what you're doing for our listeners that I may not have asked you, anything that you would like to specifically address?
Well, I'd like to talk about the recidivism rate because sometimes we hear about things and we just go about our daily, you know, operations, not understanding what's really going on with the children. The importance of Damascus Road is to keep the children from ever touching the criminal justice system. That's one of our primary goals. We know that recidivism is over 70% for people who, once they're released, they become homeless. So naturally, they're going to go back into the system. And children who touch the system at any time, there's a strong likelihood that they're going to double back and end up in the trouble again, which is why intervention is so critical. It is so important. When parents fail to parent, then the community has to stand there and be a roadblock to help the child, but do so in the right way. There's so much social intolerance for the children, and actually many of the parents need help. The children need help, but parents can't help the children if they don't have help themselves. So our program wraps around the entire family. So we draw that parent, the grandparent, the aunts, uncles, cousins, whoever is attached to that child, we draw them into the circle of this child's life so that they can support what is good and right for this particular child. I will say to you that we're not naive in that we think that we're going to save the world or save every child in this city or any other, but I do believe that if we put our best efforts out there, we will create a haven for the children and for their families to come into a safe environment where they know they will receive the appropriate service and will receive it in a manner of love where people understand them. We may not be able to fix everything that's broken, but at least we will at least have created a pathway for them to travel that may help them tomorrow with opportunities, with jobs, with how they feel about themselves, how they feel about their community. So there are a lot of things that we're simply not aware of that's going on behind the scenes.
These children that come to the attention of the schools or the state placement agency or law enforcement are not actually have not necessarily created committed a crime, but what are they? Something like not being at school when they're supposed to be at school, or misbehaving in school. How does that come about?
Let me just say, in fact, they have committed a crime. If they should be in school doing school hours and they're not in school, that's simply a status offense, which means it would be a crime for a child to trespass, but it would not be for an adult. So they have actually committed a minor offense, a status offense, and that's how sometimes they come into the light of law enforcement or, you know, I don't know, truancy or the state when they're absent from school, when they're, you know, shoplifting. So they have committed a crime. It's just a nonviolent offense.
Well, like the state placement agency might get involved because fighting in the between the mother and the father or abandonment. Or something like that.
Yes. That would be the concern of the children's services. We would not be involved at that level. That is something that the state would manage. Should they need our services, then we would be available for residential services or if they needed a child to remain with us during the day or what have you. But when these children come to the light of the state, and, you know, I cannot speak for them, but I am sure that they have to take a long, hard look at the events that brought the child to their attention.
Well, what brings a child to the attention of the state placement agency?
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to really respond to that other than to say if a child is abandoned, abused, neglected, if there are allegations regarding the home or the family or even the child. So there are a lot of reasons that the state might get involved with the family. But there are a lot of opportunities whereby the family may not need state involvement or placement if, in fact, services can go into the home to correct what is misaligned in the family. If social services can go into that home to fix that, then the child does not have to be removed from the home and the family remains, a whole unit, a whole family unit.
What would be a set of circumstances in a school that the school, one of the three agencies you mentioned, that the school would ask for your involvement?
Well, I'm not authorized to speak for the school. Let me just say that if a child is truant and is missing days out of school, the parents may need parenting classes. The child may need some academic support after school. They may need weekend support. Remember, we're offering our services 24 hours a day during non-school hours, during holiday seasons and summer. So there are a lot of opportunities for us to support the family, and, you know, through our community efforts to help them not only get on track, but stay on track to support them once we provide services and to monitor how well they're doing as a result of receiving the services.
Well, the law, and what would be a circumstance, say, for instance, of the third branch that you mentioned, law enforcement, what would be the mechanism there? Somebody in the police force would have to say it's okay to drop these kids off at Damascus Road, right?
Well, let me just start by saying that on June 10th of this year, Governor Haslam signed into law whereby the Memphis police officers are able to deliver children who have committed nonviolent offenses to a community-based site. So it would be at the discretion of the Memphis police or the Shelby County Sheriff's Department as to whether or not they would deliver the child to our facility or any other like facility. They have what they call a detention assessment tool called the DAT. And what they do, they look at this particular scoring to determine just what offense the child has committed. And I think there's something like if they score, you know, I think they can score up to 19 or something like that. Don't quote me on that. But I do know that there are some parameters that say if the child has not committed these particular offenses, you know, they should not be and cannot be transported to juvenile court. And that's where we don't want the children to go. We'd much rather have them at Damascus Road or any other community-based site. So that's what we're hoping to do is to prevent the transport of these children to that site. And let me just inject that most of the children who are transported to that site are African-American children, primarily African-American males, and the numbers are something like 97% of the children who get over there. And so imagine a child being over there for shoplifting, and so he spent whatever the appropriate time deemed by the court, but he cannot be released for a number of reasons. Well, he's now learning new skill sets in that environment. What we're hoping to do is to provide a place for him to go so he never gets over there.
Do you find a better reception from the state government than the city government?
Well, I don't know that there really is a difference. I think that there are agencies, and I guess the opinion varies from, you know, the different individuals versus state and city government. I think that both governments realize that the problem exists, that it really is real, and they acknowledge it. Now, whether or not they choose to allow a culturally competent agency to step in and take hold of the children is a whole nother ball game, because that's been a difficult route, okay? Because the thing here is that they've used the same agencies over and over again, and they've gotten the same results. And even so, there's been a matter of getting the Department of Justice involved because too many African-American children were being transported. So naturally, once they get transported, they get fingerprinted. Now we have a whole new ball of wax here. So we're trying to just prevent any of that from occurring.
Well, we have very few minutes left, and I want to thank you for being with us on the show. I mean, I feel like this is information that a lot of listeners, not only in Memphis but around the world, are not really clued in as to what takes place. That's why I was asking the questions with regard to these agencies. And really appreciate your work, and you coming on here and telling our listeners about it. I think they will find it very useful to know this and may want to do something about it wherever they are. So thanks again for being with us tonight, Sharon.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity.
And remember, her number, if you want to talk to her, is 273-4336. That's a 901 number. And also you can go to www.damascusrd.com to get more background information on Damascus Road and Sharon Page. Thank you very much for being with us. And
everyone,
be sure and go and check out iam-cor.org, the virtual campus of the Institute of Applied Metaphysics, and also iam-cor.org/blog if you want to check out the blogs. And also there are three free ebooks on this site, www.iam-cor.org. Have a good evening, everyone, and join us next week for another edition of the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program. Good night.